And the long version of the name is about a queen who was a ruler before Nefertiti. She's from ancient Ethiopia. And the legend is that she... I'm stuttering. The legend is that her people were at war, and Queen Rafini didn't want for the people of her village to die. So she left in the middle of the night and told one of her head soldiers that she was leaving, and so that they would be able to get away. And so it's the long version of the name is she who sacrificed for the love of her people. And then, you know, it's been shortened to say she who sacrifices or just sacrifices. But that's the story of Queen Rafini. She gave her life so that her people would live. And when in doing art, the person who I was going to marry told me that my life was going to end up with a bunch of children around me. That I would be an old lady one day with a bunch of children around me. And I said, and there's something wrong with that. The fact that I work with youth, I think, kind of bothered him because it took a lot of my time. But it's something that's absolutely necessary. So I think someone who feels that it's interfering is probably somewhat of a selfish person themselves. And so I felt like I deserved, not so much deserved the name, but that's how I was going to live my life, because he said, you know, you deserve the name because you're sacrificing everything. You know, you're giving up the marriage, you're giving up everything in order to do this. And I said, it's not giving up everything. But it was hard for him to understand. So it was almost like, yeah, take the name because that's what you deserve, because that's all your life is going to be, is a sacrifice. And to him, that was a slap in the face, but to me, it was an honor. I don't really feel like I'm doing anything extraordinary. Just doing what I was put here for, I believe.
And how long have you had this name?
I've had Rafini legally for about 15 years now, and I used it. You know, friends started calling me Rafini about 5 years before that.
And I saw on a website, I googled your name, and when in one website it said Rafini Spellbound, but I didn't know if it referred to you or to another Rafini.
I have no idea. Rafini Spellbound. Okay. There are a couple more Rafinis that I've heard of, one down in Florida. And I think one, it was in a tropical place, I don't remember where. But I haven't yet to meet any of them and speak with them. But I have to look at that. Look at the website.
Yeah.
Did it have any pictures?
No. The woman, I think, was doing stop the domestic violence. Or, I forget.
Really? Because I work on domestic violence things also.
Did you work with Stop the Domestic Violence Fundraiser? Was it? That is probably you. Which one was her Phoenix spelled out? I'm not sure. Just one of many things.
Oh, I should check it out. But yeah, I do a domestic violence. I have a play that I wrote about domestic violence, which is actually a story about me. But I don't say it, not out of embarrassment, but I just don't want people to be focused on me. I want them to be focused on the issue. But the story is about, you know, how I survived it and was able to, you know, come out with some dignity and raise two young men with good values, very, very good values, who I'm very proud of. And so the play is called If You Should Find, because things get lost within domestic violence situations. Usually it's the woman, her total self. And there's something called the Harlem Renaissance Garden Party, which is a fundraiser. And we've been trying to use that money to produce the play, though it hasn't been very successful because a lot of people don't turn out. And so we're learning now how to get an audience in, which it's been difficult in the past. It has been difficult. So we're actually getting ready to do workshops on how to get an audience in, how to make things successful, how to have a successful fundraiser/program. And that play was written about 5 years ago, about situations that happened over my lifetime with my first husband and then with my last fiancé. Over the years, there may have been threats, you know, verbal threats, but those two were physically abusive. And I learned to fight back. Actually, I learned to fight a long time ago with my fist. Not a good boxer, but I'm strong. And that was part of my growing up. I grew up at a time of the civil rights movement. And as a young girl, where we lived on a street, maybe a little bit like this side street here, everyone knew each other. You, as a child, you didn't deal with adults, so you didn't really deal with racism and stuff like that. You didn't really know about it. Maybe if you heard it on television, and it was just the beginning of the movement. We actually lived down a street where there was a woman who was like our adopted grandmother, and she was a bootlegger. She made her own whiskey, and she sold it, and she did numbers for the racetrack, because the racetracks at one time in Rhode Island were a very big thing, the horse races. And so she was really cool. We called her Nanny. And but from what I saw, from the perspective of being at Nanny's house, I live on a busy street next to the hospital. being at Nanny's house, we would see delivery men come by and give her things from their truck. And while they bought a half a pint of whiskey for their lunch and put in their numbers, you know, for whatever horse they felt like was going to win that day. And so I always thought that there was this kindness and that they, you know, gave things out of the kindness of their hearts. And it was never a thing. It was never an issue like you're supposed to do this or that. You know, I just thought that that was just what people did. And then my mom got sick and we had to go to a foster home. And while we were in the foster home, they condemned the houses. It was a total street of slum houses. One landlord, Mr. Schneider, owned all those houses, and they were horrible. Paint chipping. We had daisies that used to grow in the windowsill in the bathroom. Daisies and mushrooms. The houses were horrible condition. And so they condemned the houses. They made a deal with him, condemned the houses, you know, bought them all off of him and put up an elderly high rise and moved all of the families up to the projects. And so when I came out of the foster home, we lived in the projects. We no longer lived down our street. And our families were kind of scattered around the projects, 14 families. And so we had the deal now with the people within the projects who are mostly Caucasians, and I think a lot of them were Irish. So we had to deal with them because now we were the niggers. And those are words that we couldn't even use at home as young people. But now we were the niggers who were invading the projects and turning it into a dirty place. But then outside of the projects, you were the poor people who lived in the projects. So you were ridiculed twice by the people who lived there already and didn't want you there, and then the people who just didn't want that place to exist or the people at all to exist that lived there. And my first day in school, someone called me a nigger and started a fight with me, and it was really hard to understand. And so when I saw my cousins, they were at a different school, but after school, I ran into them at the projects, and, you know, they saw that we were back home again, me and my sisters and brothers. And I had asked them, what's going on? Why are people acting so crazy? What the hell's going on? And, you know, they told me about the movement. I had heard about it, but the person I lived with in the foster home was very religious and kept us from television and radio. And so I only heard a little stuff here in school, you know, here and there. And so we just, you know, they said, well, you better hang with us if you want to protect yourself. So sometime when I think about it, we might have been the first girl gang in Rhode Island. We didn't consider ourselves a gang, but it was protect yourself or get hurt. And so that's how we, as I say, that's how we rolled. You know, there were about 5 to 7 of us. Sometime my girlfriend, sometime her sisters would hang with us, sometime they wouldn't. But, you know, at any time there'd be 5 to 7 of us. And there would be times where we would just have to, you know, we used our fists to get what we needed. and I shouldn't say get what we needed, but to, I mean, if we walked in the store, you know, we could be ridiculed. If we at school, it happened until, you know, we just came down. Like, we would come as a group, and there were riots happening in school and everything in this, out in Providence and so. But anyway, that's not really part of the artist that I am now, but that's part of, that was a part of my life that was a very important part, because it was something that was sprung on me. I learned a lot from it, and I learned how to deal in the streets from it. And it has helped me. It really has. It helps me to this day, because when I talk to young people, I'm able to remember some of the stuff that I did and not judge them so much. And also able to let them know, be honest with them, of stuff that has happened in my life. So I think that it was something that was supposed to happen. It was cruel, it was harsh, but sometimes that's the way life is.
Can you tell me more about your childhood?
Which part?
Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was actually born here in St. Joseph's Hospital on Broad Street. When I was young, I think because of the way my family and my family values were, people used to think that we were from down south. A very close-knit, you know, family that cooked and, you know, yes ma'am, no ma'am, you know, kind of thing. A very, very respectful family. So people always thought we were from down south. They didn't think we were from here. And but I remember my mom saying, I was born in January, and I was born during a blizzard. And my birth name means eternal sun, eternal warmth. And my mom said that the nuns, because it was a Catholic hospital, and it was run by nuns and priests, they were the doctors and nurses. And the nurse brought me to my mom, and said, you know, your daughter's wonderful. She said, me and the other nuns have been talking, and we think you should name her Nancy. And my mom looked at me, and she said, she took one look at me and said, no, I don't think so. I don't know what she's going to be, but she's not going to be a Nancy. This kid's got something else going on. And so she named me Eternal Spring. And so I think about that. And it's, you know, I kept the first initial still out of memory of my mom. I didn't change the name because I hated her or anything. I just thought that, you know, for the arts and theater and the strength of it, that I wanted Raffini. But anyway, so yeah, I turned out to be the different kid. I was total black sheep of the family, doing stuff that none of my brothers and sisters did, always staying around the house and creating fun and stuff at, you know, and wanting to talk to my mom all the time. I learned how to cook by being in the kitchen with her all the time. And I was trying to snitch on my brothers and sisters because it was 10 of us. So I wanted to be the best. Like, I'm the good kid, you know. So I'll tell you all the bad things all the other ones did. And I love doing that. My mom used to say, you want to hear what Dahl did? She said, no, I won't tell you. She left the yard when you told her not to. And but to me, that was my way of being close to my mom. I was that kind of kid that I wanted to be up under my mother, you know, every minute if I could. I liked that safety, that comfort, you know, and it's something missing. My mom died when I was 15. Yeah, but if I could, I mean, I actually, until I moved out of the house, I slept in my, I would sneak downstairs after my mom fell asleep and get in her bed, because I just wanted to be next to her. I loved her that much. And then at the same time, we were so much alike that sometimes we would clash horribly, you know. But there was something there that she and I shared that I know that my brothers and sisters didn't share with her. And sometime also, there were stories that she told me that I tell now, and they say they never heard those stories. She never told them. I used to like to sit at her feet, put my head on her lap, and listen to stories if she had time on a Saturday, and everyone else would be out playing or something. And so I knew stories of her life. As a matter of fact, kind of a beautiful thing happened. I could call it quirky, but it was more beautiful. She used to always tell me about when I was a little girl, her friend that lived in the house with us, who lived upstairs, named Agnes Perry. And she always said Agnes Perry, first and last name. And so, you know, she always talked about her, how wonderful she was. She loved Aggie, da-da-da. That was her best friend when she moved away. How horrible it was for her. And so anyway, last year, 2 years ago, a friend of mine said, oh, Rafinha, I know you work with kids, and I've been working at a camp, and I don't want to do the camp anymore. I was wondering if you'd like to do it. And I said, sure. And so she said, okay, I'm going to give you the woman's number that runs the camp. So she gave me a number, and I called a couple of times and left my telephone number. And then the woman called me back and, you know, said, I'm calling about the camp. You know, Crystal gave me a number, blah, blah, blah. And so we did that a few times. And then she, one day Crystal was riding by, and I was in my yard doing my garden. And she said, have you talked to the woman about the camp? And I said, no, not yet. She said, well, I'm going to give you her home phone number and tell her that I did, and you call her. And so I did. I called and left a message on her answering machine. And then she called me back that night, and she said, Rafini, this is Agnes Perry, and I've been trying to get into, and I said, oh, my God. And I said, I'm sorry, we were talking at that time, and I said, Miss Agnes, I said, can I stop you for a minute? And she said, yeah. And I said, do you know a woman named Viola? And she said, I know a couple of Violas. And I said, Viola Smith? And she said, yeah. And I said, she said, who are you? And I said, I'm her daughter. I'm the determined one. You guys used to call me the determined one. And she said, oh, my God. And we both cried. I said, this is a blessing, because I said, I would have never known. But my mother always said your first and last name. So when you said, if she would have just said Agnes, I would have not, you know. You might have known that I look like my mom, but not even put two and two together. But that, to me, that was a blessing that my mom gave me that she didn't realize. Because, what, you know, 40 years later, I meet this best friend of my mom. So I get to hear more stuff about my mom that I didn't know, you know, her as a young person. So it was cool. Anyway, my life is full of little things like that. Little adventures. I think I call them my little 7-year adventures. There's always something different happening every 7 years. Yeah. Yeah.
Was your mom a single mom?
Most of the time. My mom, unfortunately, was like a lot of other women, wanting desperately to have the house and the home, the husband and family. But unfortunately, my father and my sister's father were, like most men, and constantly running. And so, yeah, there were years that my mom was alone, and then there were years that my dad was there. And I used to feel privileged and actually arrogant sometimes, like, my dad's here, and to my sister, your dad's not. And thinking that this was a special thing, but when I realized how much it must have hurt my mom every time he left, and the tears that I saw her cry, and I realized now what they were for, I realized that he was probably doing a whole lot worse than he was doing good. You know. So, yeah, that was a hard thing to see. And at the age of 45, I realized that I was carrying that baggage with me. I used to always think, I don't carry baggage from old relationships, but I was carrying baggage from my childhood, the feeling of being left behind. The feeling of going to foster homes and not knowing when we were going to come home. And because my mom was sick, there were so many of us. We went to foster homes. She had 2 heart attacks before she died. Anyway, that was something that I carried as a woman. I carried that with me, to think all the love that my mother gave, all the beauty and, you know, joy and peace that she gave out, that she got, had the end of that in return. And in the end, when my mom was dying of cancer, no one's father came to the house and said, do you all need anything? Can I help? I've taken from this house, can I give back? And so I realized that at 45, and I had to face that and say, okay, there are no guarantees. You know, whether you get married or not, there are no guarantees that this person will be around, but you have to try to make sure that they are the best person that they can be while you are together, and that they realize that it goes beyond that. I really thought that it was a pitiful shame, and I didn't feel ashamed of myself or of my mother, I thought that it was a shame that these males that call themselves men did not step forward, even if it was just to bring over a dozen of donuts or something, you know? But that'll be on their souls. You know, that'll be something, one of the things I have to answer. I think a whole lot of men are going to, in Islam, they feel that everybody spends time in hell. It's just according to how much damage you have done, how long you will be there. But we all have sins that we have to answer for. And I think a lot of men are going to find themselves there a whole lot longer than they think. Because with the beautiful creatures that God has made us, there's no way that we should not be treated much better than we're treated. And in all the holy books say that paradise lies at the feet of a woman. Then why are her feet not caressed? Why are they stepped on? So I really believe, you know, I told someone that one time, and it really hurt his feelings, and he couldn't believe. He said, "I can't believe you said that." And I said, "Well, believe it. I'm not angry with you. You'll have to answer to your Creator for what you did to one of his wonderful creations, one of his life bearers." So anyway,
and what number were you in the family?
I was number 4. My two brothers and a sister before me, and they told my mom there would be no more children. And there were 3 miscarriages before me. So that's why I was called the determined one when I got here. Because I was born sick and everything, but I was determined to stay. I was determined to stay. I remember my nanny saying that when I came home, the bandage was bigger than me. I was born with a double hernia, so they operated before I came home. She's like, this big bandage on this little child, and, you know, always sickly, bronchitis, asthma, the whole 9 yards. I'm not sure, I didn't get a chance to ask because it was, you know, never a question that I was curious about at the time, but I'm not sure if my mom might have taken any drugs in order to be able to hold on to the child. Because I know that there were some drugs for women who were having miscarriages, and they did give some complications to the children.
Yeah. And who do you consider as your family now?
I have sisters and brothers. No one replaced my mom. No one could do that. Though I have a lot of elder figures in my life. And then there's also a center where I started going and doing stuff at this elderly center, and come to find out that a lot of them women knew my mom. Wow. And, you know, this is the age that my mom would be, you know, hanging out there probably if she was still alive. And so that's cool. That's a cool connection, too. And they didn't know either until a friend who knew my mom, and they had stayed in touch, said, and knew me, said, "Oh, that's Viola's daughter." Mm. And so I thought that was funny too, another little cute connection. And I had no idea. I had gone there a few times, and, you know, they'd asked me to come back. I said, sure. And then one day she said, you know.
Yeah, your family now.
Oh, so my family now, as I said, there are other elders in my life, and I have my sisters and brothers. I just lost a brother 2 years ago, which I think that there's always a story in something, and I'm a storyteller, so, you know. But my brother was diagnosed with cancer, and it was in the kidney, and they were going to take one of his kidneys from him. And when they opened him up, they found out that it was in his liver. So we know that, you know. And strange thing is, my mom died of liver, cancer of the liver, which actually is a whole nother story, and I'll tell you that one later. But anyway, when they opened him up and saw that it was in the liver, we knew that there would be no time. They gave him, at first they gave him 6 months to 2 years, and then they said, well, you know, it'd probably be more like 6 months. But he went within 2 months. I think it's good because he didn't have to suffer too long. And another thing is, my brother was such a beautiful person. He had very good friends, and one of his best friends is very, very well to do. And so my brother was afforded to be able to die at his house in California. So he had around the clock nurse and maid. And because this guy loved my brother so much, my brother had loved his kids and, you know, taken care, was godfather to one of his children. Me and my brother born on the same day. We're 7 years apart, but we're born on the same day. And so those calls are missed, you know, the birthday calls, you know, and stuff like that. But the thing was, when my brother was dying, I was going through a time where I felt like it was like one of my 7 year, you know, advances. And what happened was I was feeling like there had to be something. I had to find another peaceful place, ways to get back to the peace that I had found once before in my life. And so I was trying to concentrate on that. But in doing that, in dealing with teenagers and teaching and dealing with the world, sometimes you're living this double identity. You know, this wonderful, peaceful person that you want to be. But at the same time, when I step out here, I'm going to make sure that people know not to screw around, you know, not to take advantage of you. And so sometimes I jump right back into the street mode. Sometimes it's not very good. Sometimes it can be very, very good for your defense, but sometimes it's just not necessary. And it takes you to a whole nother thinking. So when my brother was sick, I was working with some students in a program called Sister to Sister. And it was a very busy day. They had called me on a Monday, my brothers and sisters, and said they were going to California. I told them that I could fly out on the weekend. And so we spoke during the week, and they were telling me how my brother was doing. And so we were doing a program up here, a food program, where we were selling dinners to raise money for the Sister to Sister. And we did a walkathon that morning for the school. After we did the walkathon, we ran over to the school, got the food prepared, ran home, took a shower, came back and served the dinner. And then, you know, tired as can be, I was dropping people off that night. And as I went to drop off the last student, I have to say, the night before, I had a dream about a girlfriend of mine who had passed away. And we were looking through doorways. One doorway, there were people sitting around, and casual, watching TV, having a conversation. They turned around when the door opened and just turned back to what they were doing. And then we went to other doorways, and it was just dark in there. And I remember when we first went down the stairs, I said to my girlfriend, I think I've been here before. And she said, yeah, I think so. And that was it. And the other doorways, like I say, were just dark, and she just kept showing them. There was no more words said in the dream. She would just point, and we would float, and we would look through, not see anything, and then go to other doorways. I don't remember how, if it was a significant number of them, how many it was. But so the following night after the walkathon and the dinner and I'm bringing my students home, the final student I'm dropping off says, well, Finney, can you come inside because it was kind of late. She said, I want my mom to know that I was with you. So I said, okay. So, well, can she wave to me from the window or something? Because it really had been a long day. So she said, no, I need you to come inside. So I said, okay. So as we're walking in, walking down the stairs, and I realized this is like the dream. And I looked to my student. She looks a little bit like my girlfriend. And I said, I've never been here before, have I? And she said, no, I don't think so. So it's kind of opposite of what me and my girlfriend said in the dream. And so she opened the door, and there were some people watching TV and some people talking. I turned around, and I just waved. And she said, Mommy, I'm my teacher. You know, I said, is she okay? And that was that. And so I left. And I was like, wow, that was a trip. You know, I wonder what that means. And then I was driving down the street, and I got to the end of the street, and I got to a main street. And off to the left were three guys who were coming out of a club, and they had obviously been drinking, and they were kind of stumbling a little bit. And I turned down the street because this is the way I'm going home. And as I'm driving down the street, I don't stop because right now I'm not in peaceful, you know, let me be a peaceful person mode. I'm in, I want to get home. I'm tired, get out of my way mode. And so I'm riding down the street, and as I ride down the street, they split. Two guys go to the left, one guy goes to the right. The guy to the right is swaggering back and forth, telling them things and laughing and joking in the middle of the street. And so as I get up near him, I guess he gets this, you know, another thought, and he turns around and goes to go back in the street, and I almost hit him, so I slam on my brakes. And so when I slam my brakes, I'm like, what the hell are you doing? You know, and so he looks at me, and I said, you know, I throw my hands up like this, And all of a sudden, he just takes this long ass gun out of his and he says, "You want to fuck with me, bitch?" Mm-hmm. And so I didn't show him any reaction. I thought, that's a gun. And I just drove off at the same speed that I was driving. And I came home and I freaked out. And I didn't know what to do. I was paranoid. I didn't know what to do. You know, my brother wasn't here. I couldn't call my brother and say, what the hell do I do? You know, my brother's a Capitol Police, so he has a lot of friends on the force. And so the next morning, I was totally paranoid. I had to leave the house because the alarm went off at the school. I had to go back and reset the alarm. And I'm seeing cars. I'm wondering if people have my license plates. Is this guy going to come looking for me? And I found out the next morning that the exact time that the gun was put in my face, my brother died. And so, you know, it was 3 hours difference in California from here, and the exact time, because my brother called me in the middle of the night. I had finally fallen asleep and left a message, and he said, I'll call you tomorrow. And then he said, you know, he passed away at 7:30. And I was like, oh. And so in telling the story, I realized a few days later that it was the exact same time, because someone said, what time was it? I don't know why they asked, but anyway, it was the exact same time. So I try to look at things like, what is the message? To that message to me was, you know, your brother's leaving and your life is being spared. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Here's your next phase. What are you going to do with it? Once again, you've been given life. What will you do with it? So I'm trying my best to make the best of it and remain a good person and a strong person mentally and physically. And sometimes you have to, there are certain things that you could strive for. I mean, you could strive for a wonderful relationship, but if the relationship is mentally unhealthy, then it's not good for you and you have to let it go. So I'm trying to make sure that I remember how to do those things so that I can stay the best and strongest person that I need to be for whatever my final task may be.
Ravine, I have actually so many questions I want to ask you, but you'll have to warn me about time because I know you have to go. I want to know who do you think of as your community, and who do you work for?
Well, I'm working at UCAP right now, and I've been doing that job as a school. I've been doing that job for about 12 years now. But I feel like I don't want it to sound cliche, but I work for God. I should say I pray that one day I will be doing the work according to the way that I'm supposed to be doing it. For what I was put here for. I'm sure it was to share the arts, because that's the thing that I have in abundance. besides love and recipes. so I share them all as much as I can. But I never had the question posed, so to say, who do I work for is I guess maybe more of what I work for is unity and love and understanding, especially among our young people. Mm-hmm. They need it. A lot of times we they fall short of stuff that I want them to do, and I let them know. I try to make it a habit of, if I say something in my class that might embarrass a child, that I will come back and apologize in front of the whole class. If I made a mistake and said, you're wrong and I'm right, and did this in front of everyone, then I'm going to make the apology in front of everyone. Does it make a damn bit of difference if you pull the kid aside and say something in the hallway after you've ridiculed them or, you know, done something to call them out in front of everyone? You know, and recently it happened. one of my students, she sucked her teeth. She was in a class that she had been in with me before, and so I would allow her to do all the work sometime. But this particular time, there were particular times, you know, you have to do this, and then you can do you know, what you need to when you have finished the work that I want you to do, then you can do work from another class if you wish. And so this assignment, she didn't want to do it, and she sucked her teeth and rolled her eyes and said, you know, this is really sickening. And so I said, you're going to do it whether you like it or not. And so she said, I said, you skate a lot. And she said, what? I said, you skate a lot in here. And so I don't know if she understood the lingo. I'm like, you get away with a lot of things. There's a lot of times that the girls are doing something because you've done it last year. I don't make you do it again. I said, but today you are going to do the work that everyone else does. And so she said, she sucked her teeth again and said, this is ridiculous. So I said, do you want to take it outside? Me and you. And so she looked at me and said, I'm not playing. So you're disrespecting me here. Then we need to straighten this out. And so one of the other girls said, oh, my God, Ms. Raffini. And so she just, you know, rolled her eyes. And you know, I said, no, do the work. I said, like I say, you get away with a lot as it is. And so then later, you know, near the end of class, and we were, with the girls were handing in their paper, and I said, just I want to apologize in front of the class because I said what I said in front of the class. I didn't mean to call you outside, and I'm not going to take you outside and try to beat you up. But I also won't allow you to disrespect me in my class. I said, so apology accepted? She said, yeah. I said, it better be. So we both just laughed. And so, you know, she said, I'm sorry. I said, it's cool. You know, I said, but there are certain times that you just have to do what I need you to do, and you can't argue with me about it. You know, because you know, like I say, there's a lot of times that you don't have to do it. They put certain students in my class year after year because they know I can handle them. Not because they need what class I'm teaching. They've already taken this class, but they know that Raffini can either talk to them, or if this child gets out of hand, Raffini can handle them. So I get that a lot. You know, I get that a lot. Mm. But anyway, I'm going to tell you about this photo real quickly. This is one of my UCAP photos. Mm. And these kids, I ran into this girl recently, so I pulled the photo out and told her that I would bring it to her. We were doing a garden, and you see how she's dressed. She was Miss I Am Cute, I Do Not Touch Dirt. She was like, I might touch it, but I'm still cute. I'm not sure about this stuff. And he was like, hey, it's cool. I work with my granddad in a garden. And so this is only, it was only like about, there's about five kids missing. And so, what were you going to ask?
Well, what do you teach at UCAP?
I teach everything. I usually teach theater, and that's what I started teaching was theater, but I do poetry. And this just happened to be a nice year, and it got warm early. And there was a community gardens here, and they had offered a program for the students to start a garden. So they chose me, Miss Earth. And so... yeah, so we started the garden. It was so funny. We had a young man who was gay, and he was like, I'm not getting my nails dirty. He got his nails done every week.
Oh, wow.
And he's like, I'm not getting my nails dirty. I'm not touching dirt. You didn't bring gloves? And I said, no, I didn't bring gloves. We need to touch the earth. We need to experience the earth. And so anyway, the funniest thing was I saw these children transform over a matter of 5 weeks. The kids who were talking about not putting their hands in dirt, not wanting to get any bugs. You know, when we first went there to turn the dirt over, they were saying, oh, my God, what's this bug? What's that? You know, and they were screaming and running. And so then we came back and we turned it over again and we gave it some fertilizer. And after maybe about 3 weeks, the bugs, the pods that they were finding, it was funny to them after a while, you know, like, oh, I found a pod, you know. And so, you know, I told them to, you know, respect the pod and put it back into the earth so that it could fully develop. But one of the girls' dads one day, it showed me how much the kids were starting to respect working in the dirt. That one day the kid's dad rode by and saw us in the garden and asked if they wanted anything from Dunkin' Donuts because he was on his way there. And so he brought back a bag of donuts. And so they were so busy, they said, well, just so you know, they sat it down on the ground and continued to work. And I think we were weeding that day. And on our way back to the school, as we were walking, the kids said, you know, I'm starving, open that bag of donuts. And so one of the girls said, oh, dirt got in the bag. And they were like, you better wipe that dirt off. I ain't worrying about that dirt. I'm starving, right? And so I'm like, kids who did not want to touch dirt now are willing to just wipe dirt off these donuts and eat it. And so I saw this beautiful transformation. And one day we came to the garden, and a friend of mine, who calls herself Moon Bear, was at his plot. And he was praying. And so the kids said, what is he doing? And I said, he's praying over the land. They said, why? I said, he's praying before he breaks the land to give respect and say that I'm going in plant seeds. I would take from the land, but I would give back to the land. And they're like, wow, that's weird. And so the cute thing was we had a week off from school. So when we came back 2 weeks later to our garden, Moon, who had planted seeds, we planted plants, already started. Moon's plants were taller than ours. And he had planted seeds, but he prayed over his land. The kid said, We've got to pray. So it was the life lessons that they learn, and you get to see them learn them sometimes are so, so precious. Mm-hmm. But this turned into a group of kids who used to come to the garden during the summer because school was about to end. Mm-hmm. And so I told them once a week to come to the garden. We would meet at the garden. Not everybody came every week, but we'd meet at the garden, and they'd get to fill up bags and take the vegetables home that they grew. They did a lot. They did greens, broccoli, tomatoes. We did about 7 different kind of tomatoes and herb bushes. They were very, very good. Really nice plants. So, yeah, some sweet memories.
One of the things, so I keep hearing, you do so much, Ravini. I've heard about, there's jewelry making at a people school, gardening, you're teaching, you're a teacher, and, I've heard people talk about you as a self-made artist, and how did you learn all this? How do you become a self-made artist?
I'm going to be totally honest with you. I think the only difference between me and the sister on the streets is God, my strong belief in myself that my mother instilled in me, and the good people that God has put in my life. I have a friend who told me that she looks at life that she says failure is not an option. So she doesn't let it be an option in her plans. It's just not part of the scheme. Mm-hmm. To fail is not, homelessness is not an option. We have to work, I don't really look at it as options. I think that that's beautiful, and I've been telling my students that also. But I looked at it as, I've been through some hell. There's been some really crazy stuff that's going on in my life. But in 84, a friend of mine, who now is so proud of me, and I say, do you realize that I owe this to you, I was hanging around doing nothing with my life, getting high, and bored as hell. And I had dropped out of school, had been out of school for years, married and divorced. And so I was just bored with what was happening. I was like, okay, I'm bored. And I knew there's something else, but I wasn't ready to take those steps to do that something else. And she came by one day, and I was like, I'm so bored. I'm sick of this, and I'm smoking my joint, and I'm chilling out and watching soap operas, which is horrible. They're horrible things, you can get hooked on them, it's a wonderful story, but I think that they're put on to make women fail, because they're on at the time of the day. You're not going out for a friggin' interview once they come on. You got the morning talk shows, and if you watch them and you go into your soap operas, you're just not leaving the house to be productive. And so, anyway, I was sitting around doing nothing, watching my soap operas and getting my next high on. And, I'm like, this place is so boring. She said, get your ass up and do something. And so I said, yeah, I will. And so she said, why don't you go back to school? And I said, I was thinking about it. And she said, well, instead of thinking about it, why don't you go back over and inquire? I said, well, I will, And she's like, no, do it now. And I said, yeah, I will, tomorrow. She said, no, now. So I said, yeah. So I'm like, yeah, I will. I said I'm going to. She said, then get up and do it. And so I'm like, leave me alone, will you? She snatched me off my couch, literally drag me through my house. I'm fighting. I'm like, get off me. Leave me alone, And she drug me into my bathroom and pushed me into the shower. And she said, we're going over to the school. And so I'm like, leave me alone. I'll go tomorrow. I'll go in the morning. I promise. She said, no, we're going now. And so I was like, you're a pain in the ass. So I took a shower and we walked over to the school, signed up. Come day of orientation, I planned on going, but she rang my doorbell and went to orientation with me. And it opened up a door that, was like, I needed that door opened. And the first day of orientation, a woman named Joyce Jarrett did a piece from Sojourner Truth called Ain't I a Woman? Mm-hmm. And I had wanted to do theater for years, but never had the guts to ask somebody, how do I get involved? Always shy to back, when I got the opportunity, I was shy away. And, excuse me.
Oh, don't worry.
So, anyway, I Joyce did the piece and brought tears to my eyes. And at the end of class, I went up and I went to say, how do I do that? How do I get to do that? But the words wouldn't come out. All I got to tell her was how much I enjoyed it. And then one day when I was walking, maybe about 3 or 4 months after that, I was walking to the cafeteria. And what I had gone to school for was a word processing course. And really as a glorified secretary, taking dictaphone all day long. I was like, oh, no way. Wrong class, right? And so I was going to drop out, and they said no. It was just this 9-month program that was paid for by the Rockefeller Foundation for single women who had been out of school for more than 5 years. And so, my friends convinced me with all the time they had put in to stay. So, but while I was walking through the cafeteria one day, a woman named Stella Reed, who's one of my best and dearest friends, I love her dearly, stopped me, and she said, and so, like I say, sometimes the street mentality comes back in. She was sitting with a guy who had been making eyes at me all week long, and they were sitting together, and he had actually made a wink at me while they were sitting, and she noticed it. You know, she looked at him and looked over at me, and so he said something to her, and then later she said to me, can I talk to you? So I'm like, oh, here we go, right? So I went to the room with her and into her office, and I closed the door behind me, and she, I remember her turning around and looking at me, and so she reaches down into her desk and she pulls out these papers and she says to me, can you read this for me? And I'm like, she's trying to question my intelligence, you know? And so I'm like, I'm getting insulted, right? So I start reading this thing for her. And so, and then she goes, I like the way you read. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't, you know, it's not like I sat here and read this wonderful thing for you, you know? What do you mean you like the way I read? So I'm really thinking that she's messing with me. And she says, I'm doing a play and da da da, and I want you to do this. I want you to be in this play.
Oh, I was like,
really? And she said, yeah. And it's so funny because when we got to be good friends later, when I said, remember when we were in the office and that day you stopped me? And she said, yeah. And she said, I always wonder why you closed the door. I said, I figured if we're going to fight, this keep it between us, not the whole school. She's like, you serious? You thought I wanted to fight you? I said, yeah. I figured you were John's girlfriend and you were jealous because he was making eyes at me. I said, that's what the kind of reaction that I was used to at that particular time. So there are times where the street mentality and street mode jumps in. There are times where it can save your ass, but there's also times where it can put you in crazy, awkward positions. So, but anyway, that's how I started doing theater. And but I've always been interested in like talent shows and stuff like that and teaching. I actually started a school, a preschool, pre-Head Start, called Start Ahead, Stay Ahead in 74. Yeah, 74. I was still a teenager. But me and some of the other moms, I was a teenage mom. Me and some of the other moms up there wanted to something for our children to do. And plus it was a way for us to be involved in life and in this teaching aspect. And so, yeah, the program lasted for a year. I was only there for a year. And I actually moved on and started working at Head Starts. So I've been working with children all my life. Even as a little kid, I loved mm-hmm. kids, loved them. They're so precious, most precious gift. And it's, you know, it's hard to believe that there are people out there who actually want to hurt them. When I see a baby, I see a child, it's hard to really conceive that somebody would actually think of hurting this precious little baby, precious little gift. There's just something about them that truly warms my heart. Mm. Yeah. And I guess my mom was the same way with 10 of us. You know? But, so what else? Anything else?
Oh, yeah. So it seems like you have a strong connection to where you grew up, too, right, in Providence?
Yeah, even when I lived in Riverside, I lived out there for 13 years, and people still thought I lived in Providence. They had no idea I didn't live in Providence because I'm always here, and my work is done here. It's a strong spiritual connection. I remember when I moved back to the South Side from Pawtucket, I would actually at sometimes wake up. I used to hit the numbers a lot because I would play the lottery. But I would wake up with numbers in my hand. I would wake up knowing something was going to happen. The I guess you would call it mental telepathy, I don't know, was very, very strong. And I think it has something to do with the spirits of the black people who have died around here. It always brought a positive vein. I mean, I was hitting numbers. I was winning lottery left and right. You know, I'd wake up and say, oh, this is the number. And I mean, not every day, but it would come to me sometime. One time, this girl, when we were at school, a girl gave me a hug, and she used to go with my boyfriend's brother, and she hugged me, and something said, she's screwing Steven. As clear, I mean, those were the exact words. And I looked at her, and she said, what's wrong? And I said, nothing, nothing. And I'm thinking, no, you can't, this must be jealousy. Why would you think something like that? She goes with his brother. And sure enough, 2 days later, she walked in with the bag that I had given Steven that looked like a book bag, but it was really an overnight bag. And she walked in with the bag. And I was like, oh, so stuff like that, things like that, when I lived over here, were so, so clear. And an incident happened when I was doing a play, and a woman told me that, which made me even more convinced that I was on the right track. That some of us choose to do what we do, but some of us are chosen. And she felt that God chose me to do what I was doing now, so I had to make sure that what I did, that I would be proud of, and never do anything that would compromise who I was. But it was for me to go out and do it, you know. So I delved more into the arts.
So, do you feel a sense of community here in Providence?
Absolutely. I need a good tissue.
Community in Providence?
I feel a very strong sense of community in Providence because, as I say, most of my time is spent here. And a big connection with friends also here. And I don't know why it's stronger than Pawtucket, because I lived in Pawtucket for a long time also. Mm-hmm. But I think in a way it may be more positive for me. I think it probably has a lot to do with the fact that I was born out here. Mm-hmm. And whatever my mom saw in me, to keep her from naming me Nancy, is what is happening and what draws me back to this place.
And you mentioned before, when I was asking about community, that you were working for unity. Mm-hmm. And I was, is there unity among a specific group of people, or for what?
As a black woman, I would love unity among the black women, mm-hmm. and among the black families. Mm-hmm. But unity as people of color, of all the people of the diaspora, because we have been thought so long to think little of ourselves. And there have been mind tricks, as my girlfriend calls them, mind fucks, throughout the years, throughout the centuries of making. I mean, for the longest time, they made Africa look very, very small on the map. They call us minorities when we're majority. Mm-hmm. And we believe we're minorities. If you believe you're small, insignificant, inferior, that's a hell of a legacy to carry, to pass on. And so I have a desire, my dream is going to be to open a learning center called the Future Village. And Future Stands is an acronym for a foundation for unity for unity through understanding, respect, and equality. And the idea is to have elders from the community and professors from different colleges and stuff to come in and work with preschool children and work with each other. And then in the afternoon, when the high school and junior high school kids get out of school, to come by and work for an hour or so. So we'll have four generations working together for an hour or two a day, and then the younger generation will take over so that the elders go home. And in that, to have foster grandparent programs and just programs where we foster love, period, and to learn about other people's cultures, not just American history, not just African American history, which both have been falsified, and I'm sure into other cultures, the histories also have been falsified, to know the people who we deal with every day, to interact, you know. I mean, if I didn't know any better, I could say, well, this Chinese girl came to my house to interview me today, you know, and I, whatever, you know, some would say, well, she's not Chinese, you know, well, yeah, whatever, whatever, you know. It's not whatever. We have to stop whatever and know the facts, know about people's cultures so we stop judging so much, and know just because it's something that you don't agree with doesn't mean that it's wrong. And we have to have that, because what has happened is it's no longer going to be about race soon. It's going to be about the classes. And all of our races are thrown into these melting pots that they call the ghetto. And some of us who make a little bit of money feel that we have moved on and, you know, maybe live in the burb somewhere. But as my mom says, when it gets down to the get down, you know, what are we going to do as a people? And if all of the people of color united, we'd be a hell of a force. But even among ourselves, the ranks are broken. African Americans, Africans, Cape Verdeans, mm-hmm. Jamaicans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, you know, Haitians. You live in the same island and we're hating one another. Mm-hmm. They have taught us to hate one another. As long as they keep us divided, they can come in and conquer whenever they want to. So they've taught us from birth, from childhood, to hate one another. The movies that they put out there, all of the movies are so negative. You know, and I try to explain to people, when people in other countries see these movies and all we're playing is hoes, pimps, pushers, you know, and shoot them up, bang, bang, you know. And then when they come here, then they see some of that. It feeds what they've learned, all this. So, of course, they think that. And this is the image that people have. This is the image that we're sending out, and we don't realize it, but people, the dollar gets in the way, and they don't realize the message that they're sending behind trying to bring in the money. So, anyway, I feel like we really need to know about each other's culture. We need to know about each other's culture, the people who are living right next door to us, across the street from us, people we interact with every day and don't know. We remain ignorant about each other and ignorant about ourselves, because we're believing what we're told and we're not digging any deeper to find out the real facts. And I want to teach these facts at my center. I want to teach these facts, and I want to teach to embrace people in the neighborhood. And if a child doesn't have a parent, or a child has a parent who's a junkie and doesn't want to come and be part of this child's life, then we embrace this child. Try to encourage the mom. Try to encourage the parent. But in the meantime, this child needs love and to know that somebody cares.